We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
As we go through, today we're looking at three chapters in Ecclesiastes, chapters 4, 5 and 6. But let me just do a bit of a recap from last week so as to put these into their context and so as to help those who were not able to be with us last week and hadn't found their way here. That is, what we have before us is really something of a meaningless meander. Meander because the structure seems to be going nowhere. It just goes round and round and themes arrive only to disappear again. And we make progress only to have it undone. But that is because the structure is reflecting the message that it's trying to teach. That is that life is meaningless. So the topic sentence of the whole book there in verse 2 of chapter 1, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. So we mustn't expect that we're going to have the A to Z on how to live. It's about the meaninglessness of life, and it's going to go in anything but a direct line. It wanders around in meaninglessness, each of the themes coming and going. But the great theme is meaninglessness. Today in chapters 4 to 6 there are several themes, and I've grouped them together under three headings: materialism, meaninglessness and relationship. The ushers look like they're ready. Away we go. If you're ready to pass those on, where's the easiest way? Pass to the outside. That'll be easier. So if you pass on the outside, and that'll leave Simon carrying up the middle collecting nothing. That's just helpful. We'll get it over and done with now. So three headings: materialism, meaninglessness and relationship. What I'm going to do is read through the three chapters fairly quickly. You might like to get in a position where you can see. It's always helpful to bring a Bible to campus Bible study. But show it to the people around about you if they've come as guests and visitors and not know to bring one. We'll be reading quickly through these three chapters so as to make sure that we read them sequentially, though in a sense you don't need to read them sequentially because they're meandering. But then I'll come back and look at the three themes in turn and illustrate each of the themes by picking on verses on the way back through. So we will effectively, if I can do it, read through the passage almost twice, once just as it stands in the Bible, and then once under these three themes that I take it are here. Chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes. Again I looked and I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed and that they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. And I saw that all labour and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbour. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Better one hand with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Again I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone who had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless and miserable business. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Better a poor but wise youth than an old foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them. But those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is a meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Guard your steps and you... When you go to the house of God, go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know that they do wrong. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven, and you are on earth. So let your words be few. As a dream comes when there are many cares, so the speech of fools, fool when there are many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay in fulfilling it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to vow than to make a vow and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin, and do not protest to the temple messenger, my vow was a mistake. Why should God be angry at what you say and destroy the work of your hands? Much dreaming, many words are meaningless. Therefore, stand in awe of God. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things, for one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of a labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son there is nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain since he toils for the wind? All his days he eats in darkness with great frustration, affliction and anger. Then I realised that it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given him, for this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. I've seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions and honour so that he lacks nothing his heart desires, but God does not enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This too is a meaningless, a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and doesn't receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes without meaning. It departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but fails to enjoy his prosperity, do not all go to the same place? All man's efforts are for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. What advantage is a wise man over a fool? What does a poor man gain by knowing how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Whatever exists has already been named, and what man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? For who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and meaningless days he passes through life like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone? Well, it's not happy time, is it? You can never really say that, hey, it's great to be at campus Bible study studying Ecclesiastes because it's so full of joy and happiness, life and verve. It just is meaningless and meaningless and more depression, and if you really understand it, it's worse. So, let's look at the themes. The first theme that I want to draw your attention to is the dominant one in this part of the book, that is materialism, or consumerism, or the good life, as the heading of the study takes it today. Our society is dominated in this way of thinking. It comes out of intellectual materialism, though most people don't attach it to that. See, intellectual materialism, or accidentalism, epiphenomenalism if you want, or whatever it may be, sees all of life is nothing else than matter. That there is no existence except for material existence, and it has all been here forever, or it has come into some explosive force through a big bang, but here it is, and that is it, and there is nothing else to it. It is all just here. Well, whatever you want to say, be it atoms or subatomic particles or energy particles or whatever you think is the smallest unit of existence, the whole of everything is just made up of that small unit of existence added together with all the other small units of existence until you have us, the universe. And it is reducible to matter, for there is nothing else but matter. Now, while that is a common enough philosophical view, and it actually gives us a philosophical basis, materialism, the most common form of materialism is Mr. and Mrs. Average Suburbanite, who are just enjoying being consumers. In the United Kingdom, a report that came out when I was over there showed that the greatest, most favourite form of relaxation and enjoyment for the average English person was shopping. Now, that tells you something about the weather in England. Their lack of sporting prowess and a whole range of other things. But on the other hand, I'm not sure Australians aren't all that different at this point. Hanging at the mall is still one of those kinds of activities that people like to do. Shopping is a very important pastime for us. It's just because of pleasure, the pleasure of wealth and possessions, of going out and owning and being able to have people look after you, provide for you, say yes sir, and treat you as always in the right. People love shopping. Now, crass materialism is ridiculed by everybody. It's obviously stupid. But yet, remember friends, crass materialism is just the ethical lifestyle of atheism. If there is nothing else in this world other than the physical world, then there is nothing else to do but gather as much of the physical world as you can. If there is no other meaning or purpose, there is nothing outside of just sensations, you might as well get as many sensations, as nice a sensations as is possible. So whatever it is that makes your sensations nice, happy, pleasurable, yours, then you do it, because after all, there is no meaning to life beyond the material existence. Like I say, every suburbanite doesn't think it out like that, do they? The other part is the average atheist doesn't think it out like that either. But the average atheist will not follow Mr. Nietzsche and company. What they'll say is, there is nothing to this world other than the material accident, and that's why we must be loving and truthful and kind and just, which is profoundly irrational. It's the old naturalistic fallacy. Because there is, therefore we must. Nothing. Is equals is. Because there is, therefore there is. You can't say because there is, therefore we ought. If there is only is, if we only accidentally exist, then all there is accidental existence. So, exist. For there is nothing else. See, the average atheist is not consistent, and the average materialist is not consistent. But materialism dominates in a wealthy society like ours. And materialism is really what the University of New South Wales is about as well. For although education is the mythology that lies behind this institution, and research is a mythology that lies behind this institution, yet fundamentally it is part of the process of youth growing into professional upward social mobility of an economic character. It has to do with qualifications. It has to do with acceptance in the community as a person qualified for professional life with all the benefits and status and increased wealth that comes from it. The average United States graduate earns four times as much in their working life as the non-graduate. That is what we are about, friends, getting on to that kind of escalator that moves upwards. Some of us en route get educated. That is an accidental byproduct of the institution. And some great research has taken place here. That is also an accidental byproduct. Because most of the university lecturers have to spend their time now making sure that the university is funded properly, and most of the students have to make sure they're qualified so as to earn bigger salaries properly. The activity of education is the mythology which keeps us going. Now, when we look at the materialism here in Ecclesiastes, notice first of all the source of it in chapter 4, verse 4, that is envy and greed. And I saw that all the labour and all the achievements spring from man's envy of his neighbour. Oh, that too is meaningless and a chasing after wind. Here is where capitalism is so right. Competition is the motivator for most people's activity. Competition will drive us on and lead us to do better and better things. And this is where the advertisers are right. We want to see what others have. And when we see what others have, then that is what we want. We want what they have. We do not want what we need. We've had that for many, many years. We do not want what is good for us. The advertisers wouldn't recognise it any more than we do. We do not want what will help other people. We want what other people have got. And fundamental to that, of course, is a competition which is antisocial. My chief aim in life is beating you. When, of course, you mark on the curve, which our society has seen fit to do so, you're marking competitively. We're not interested in everybody in the class learning to a certain stage whereby we can pass everybody. We're interested in a certain percentage of the class doing better than another percentage of the class. And those, the percentage that does well is the ones who win. And so our aim is not to learn, our aim is just to make sure we do better than the person beside us. That's, well, enough of the people beside us. That is the key, isn't it? For if I've done better than the others, I pass, and therefore qualify. Whether or not I know anything, I've just got to do better than the people beside me. The economic rationalists would tell us there's no point complaining about an unfair and unjust, unkind system. This is reality. Economics is reality. This is the decision. This is how we make decisions. It's in the competitive jungle of the economic world of Western civilization. That is how decisions are made. Be rational. Face the way life is. Supply and demand rules. But notice, secondly, the outcomes, for there are several mentioned here. Firstly is oppression. Verse 1, again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. Over chapter 5, verse 8 to 10, 5. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and the justice rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them is yet another one. Oppression is normal. Whoever loves money has not money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is a meaninglessness. No system built on envy of neighbours will be free of oppression. You see, we enjoy relatively cheap clothing here in Australia because we have the Southeast Asian sweatshops to provide for us. We cannot afford our own workers in the clothing industry because the unions have insisted that the workers get a fair wage. So we have pushed our companies offshore where we can have people who can work for next to nothing and who have got no unions to stand up for their rights, and so we can enjoy cheap clothing. Not you personally, not me personally. It's just when you go to the shops, you buy that which is cheap because it is so much cheaper than the locally produced thing. And why is it so much cheaper? Because some people are oppressed overseas, offshore, where our laws do not reach. It's the character of this world. Then there's greed and there's toil. No one can be manipulated quite so much as into overtime, into workaholicism, like the materialist. So in chapter 4, verse 6, you see, better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and the chasing after the wind. The desire for more and more and more means that you can always be manipulated into toil and hard work. And there is the failure to enjoy the wealth that is acquired. The man in verse 8 who is working all alone, has no one to share it with, is putting off enjoyment, putting off enjoyment, putting off enjoyment till he's old enough to have acquired enough that he's too old to enjoy it. He has no teeth to eat it with. He has no memory to remember what to enjoy anyway. Why, the end to the toil. Or chapter 5, verse 11 following. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of a labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. He goes on, I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there's no one to leave it, no one, sorry, there's nothing left for him. See, life is nothingness in the end. You come in with nothing and you leave with nothing. You can't take it with you. There's no pockets in a funeral shroud. You've got to share it with somebody else. But yet, if you have nobody else to share it with, what are you doing? Acquiring more and more so as to have a really elaborate funeral coffin? What is the point of it all? The acquisition of it, the source, the acquisition, the outcomes, it's meaningless. And so the chief outcome is dissatisfaction, which runs right through this passage. The dissatisfaction that is reflected by those who see that one handful with tranquility is better than two handfuls with toil. Rather than pursue the mighty dollar, I'll just have less and relax and enjoy myself. Because after all, chapter 5, 12, the sleep of a labourer is sweet, but he who has abundance, it gives him no sleep. The wealth actually makes you worried, makes you anxious, makes you concerned. You are continue to be in trouble because of the wealth. Or look down to chapter 6, verse 7. All man's efforts are for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. What advantages is a wise over a fool? What does a poor man gain by knowing how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Here is one of the problems of the super rich, the Murdochs, the Packers, the Bill Gates of this world. They're never satisfied. They never say, enough, I've got enough. They've got more than enough already, haven't they? They'd be hard-pressed to spend the rest of their lives just giving away what they've got. They have so much. But you do not see them saying, I have enough. They're always out to buy another company. They're always out to make another gamble. Yet to possess goods and not to enjoy them is meaningless. What's the point of always possessing more and more? Better never to have been born, he says, chapter 6, verse 1. I've seen another evil under the sun. It weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions, honour, so that he lacks nothing his heart desires, but God doesn't enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This too is meaningless, a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and doesn't receive proper burial, I say a stillborn child is better off than he. What have you gained to have a huge bank account and no time to enjoy it? No people to share it with. It's handed over to others. See, here is the folly that Jesus speaks of in his parable in Luke chapter 12. Of the man who finally reaches retirement with enough possessions so that he can build big barns and store them up and live for the rest of his life in peace and ease, only to drop dead there and then. The final last barn is built, the bank account is clearly established, and then death comes suddenly upon him. One of the problems of retirement is this, and the more high-pressured the job, the more it is the case that within the first 12 months of retirement you've got a very good chance of death. A very high death rate in that first 12 months. Women's Weekly used to run a world cruise full of widows. Men who had spent their lives working to send their widows around the world on the P&O liners. So given the source, the outcomes and the dissatisfactions of materialism, it's not surprising that the second theme that is there is meaninglessness. The author twice expresses the meaninglessness of a materialistic life in terms of better not to live. See, chapter 4, verses 2 and 3 are pretty harsh. I declare that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive, but better than both is he who has not been yet born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. But if that is harsh, the one in chapter 6 is harsher still. I say at the end of verse 3, a stillborn child is better off than he. Comes without meaning, departs in darkness. In darkness its name is shrouded, though it never saw the sun or knew anything. It has more rest than does that man who lived 100 lives and yet still didn't have an opportunity to enjoy his wealth. Better never to have been born, to spend your life acquiring all your wealth and not do anything with it. What was the point? What was the point of building the empire that you never lived in? Building the palace that you never went inside? Creating the finest, fabulous artwork that you could never see? Writing the ultimate symphony that you could never hear? What is the point? You've acquired all this and have got nothing. Better never to have started. Socrates said the unreflective life is not worth living, but Ecclesiastes expresses it in terms of the utter futility of life, spent pursuing possessions which you never enjoy. To make acquisitions, the end goal of life is stupidity itself. Yet there's a board game that came out a few years ago called The Game of Life. And the rules were whoever had the most money at the end wins. And it became something of the motto of the 80s, where, if you remember, they also kept on saying greed is good, but they kept on talking in terms of whoever has the most money at the end wins. But no one ever asked, wins what? I mean, one of the classic things about board games is you win nothing. That's the end point, isn't it? At best, you've won monopoly money. You've won nothing. And that is what happens if money becomes the indication of the success of your life. Your life has succeeded at nothing. Possessions in themselves are meaningless and futile. Chapter 5, verse 11. The goods increase, so do those who consume them, and what benefit are they to the owner, except to feast his eyes upon them? You saw it sent up in the old comic strips of Donald Duck, where he had old Uncle Scrooge, who had all the money, if you remember, and he had it in huge roomfuls of gold coins that he used to dive into and play in, as if it was kind of like plastic balls, a swimming pool full of money. It was stupid. It was utterly stupid. You have so much money you do not know what to do with it. There is nothing to do with it. It, in the end, is valueless. The marker of value. Possessions in themselves are meaningless and futile. They can be hoarded, but only to harm the owner. Poor people do not need security locks and TV monitors outside their homes and alarms. Wealthy people turn on their beds in anxiety, sleeplessly fighting off the indigestion from their overindulgence. What do we achieve? Both wind up in the grave. See, the capitalistic success of our Western civilization is built on greed and oppression and has not delivered a happier society of purposeful individuals, but emptiness and meaninglessness, with its futile attempts to find anesthetics in a bottle or in drugs or in gambling or in the counselling or in new age mumbo jumbo or in swapping partners in the marriage go-round called divorce or in the acquisition of something that'll be newer, bigger, better, that will somehow make life meaningful. It is said that the two happiest days of a man's life are the day he bought his first boat and the day he sold it. You look all over Australia, and in front gardens and in streets and in garages everywhere are boats that people never travel in, that never see water from one day to another, who only hose down so as to keep the spiders from inhabiting them. We have money, we have possessions, but we do not know what to do with them. So we pop more pills, or we go and play more poker machines. What is the meaning of playing poker machines? Why do people pour millions and millions of dollars into poker machines? You know you can't win on a poker machine, don't you? They're actually geared so that they will repay 95% of what you put in. I think it's 95%. There's legislation changes from time to time, but last I read it was 95%. So every time you put in $100, you get 95 back. And then you put 95 in and you'll get 95% of that back. And then 95, and so eventually, ultimately, you must lose everything. And the only way you can win is pull a jackpot on the first pull and never do it again. That is the only way. The longer you play, the more certain it is that you will lose everything you put in. So, if that is the case, why do people play them? boredom, hope, frustration, meaninglessness, the emptiness of life? What's your hobby? I play the poker. You've got to get a life, haven't you? But it's not just one or two. There are thousands and thousands of people who are doing it night after night. There are huge palaces and empires built on poker machine playing. As people in hope, in the adrenaline rush of hearing the money tumbling down the bottom of the machine, as people anaesthetize themselves against how meaningless and pointless and futile their labor has all been and their life is and their work is. Now our left-wing socialist friends who are sitting here rubbing their collective hands together are collectively enjoying the Bible teaching pointing out the stupidity and immorality of capitalism and economic rationalism. Your hope is for justice, for government intervention that will prevent the rich from oppressing the poor, and so that they will have higher values than greed and envy and acquisition and power. But Ecclesiastes is no more socialist than is capitalist. Capitalism may be corrupt, but socialism is a confidence in government is a naivety which is in fact a dangerous, to the point of dangerous stupidity. Chapter 4, verse 13, 4:13. Better a poor young wise youth than an old foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them. But those who came later were not pleased with the successor, and this too is a meaningless chasing after the wind. Down chapter 5, verse 8, if you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them are both who are others higher still, and the king, the increase from the land is taken by all, and the king himself profits from the fields. Friends, governments are never going to bring us any change. Governments are part of the problem. Is taken by all, and the king himself profits from the fields. Friends, governments are never going to bring us any change. Governments are part of the problem as much as they are in any way the solution. See, the problem is not with the system, as Rousseau would have it. The problem is with individuals. Here's Mr. Moyer and our local governments, Liberal parties and Labor parties on the high moral ground, publicly divided, arguing with each other. But I like the other side of the cartoon too. For that is where they are united, in fleecing the public. That's where it's at, isn't it? For it doesn't matter whatever else happens, the one thing that you will always find the parties agreed upon is an increase to the politician's paycheck, an increase to the perks that go with being in power. That is part of what government is about. Whatever else is certain, taxation is certain, and that will increase whatever way. Whoever we appoint to power will be corrupted by the power, because we are in fact corrupt creatures. There will be no justice in this world. It will never be. But you don't have to go just for politicians. Let's look at us. Lawyers. Do they create justice for us, or do they create wealth for lawyers? I'm sorry, but it's wealth for lawyers at the moment, isn't it? The only people who win our court cases are lawyers. They're the only winners. Justice is not the key part of our land. But you don't have to just go for the high flyers. Social workers. They have fought a great fight and have now established their professional status and therefore professional salaries in their concern to help the poor. The one poor group that they have made sure are looked after properly are themselves. Gone are the days of voluntary almoners caring for poor. Now are highly paid professionals caring for the same poor who never actually are brought out of their poverty. It is the same. We are caught in the system. It's not just them out there, it's us. We are part of it. So the author says all is meaningless. Chapter 6, verses 10 to 12. What's the point? In the end, death reigns. 6:10-12, whatever exists has already been named. Whatever man has is been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? For who knows what is good of a man's life during the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone? It's all meaningless. That is how there is no point to our existence. John Paul Sartre mentioned to you last week. Every existing thing is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. It's all like that. All this is pretty depressing stuff, you can say, Philip. I'm depressed enough in life without coming to campus Bible study. And I can work all this out without campus Bible study. Sartre did. So can I. You just have to look around the world and you can see meaningless. The only answer is to drop out. Chapter 4, verse 5 tells you not to do that. The fool folds his hands. Gee, you all learned that one up quickly, didn't you? The idea of dropping out, that's a possibility. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. You know, I'm not going to do anything. Well, that's even worse. So I'm going to work hard for what? You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Is there nothing positive that can be said? Yes, there is. Relationships. For here, our author does turn to something positive. Firstly, notice human relationships in chapter 4, verses 8 to 12. It's partly the hopelessness of living alone for self in verse 8, but it's partly the utilitarian, the pragmatic advantages of friendship in verses 9 to 12. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. Pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how will one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Friendship has tremendous advantages. In friends, we are more than the sum of the parts. We find real purpose and assistance in our actions for the other person's benefit. Part of what is so dreadful about death is the breaking of friendship, is the loneliness of it. Chapter 6, verse 14, it's losing all and not being able to leave it to anybody is what makes it so depressing. So while we have human relationships, we have some meaning, some value. Not the total meaning of life is being said here, but this is better. It's better to have friends than not to have friends. It's better for two of you than to be alone and just one. More important, though, is the relationship with God. For God lies behind the whole of this universe as the creator and ruler over all our existence. So maybe our work and our pleasure are all that we've got, but they are given to us by God. And in accepting God's sovereignty over them, we can find meaning in them. Chapter 5, verses 18 to 20 is like chapter 2, verses 24 to 26. Chapter 5, 18. Then I realise that it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of his life God has given him, for this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. When you perceive the sovereignty of God, when you accept the sovereignty of God, when you accept the wealth and possessions and the time to enjoy them as a gift of God, then you can find meaning and purpose and satisfaction in them. The satisfaction is not in the things themselves, but in the acceptance of the God who has given them to us. Our relationship with God is different to human relationships. In human relationships, there is mutual benefit and help. We struggle together and help each other, but the relationship with God means that we must humbly accept whatever he provides for us. And we must humbly accept whatever he says to us. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 7. Guard your steps. Quite different to the rest of the book, the rest of the three chapters, this little section, wasn't it? Guard your steps. Chapter 5, verse 1. When you go to the house of God, when you go into the temple, the place where sacrifice is done, the place of the judgment seat of God, where the place where God deals with sin, when you go to the house of God, go near to listen, rather than to offer a sacrifice of fools who do not know that they do wrong. That's the trouble with fools. They don't even know that they've done wrong. They don't know how offensive, insulting they are to God, but they romp into his presence and start talking. Chapter 5, verse 2, do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God's in heaven, you're on earth. So let your words be few. As a dream comes when there are many cares, so the speech of a fool when there are many words. After church last Sunday night, I had turned on television. It was the end of a movie. Can't think of the name of the movie, but it was about a man experimenting with humans, with street people, trying to create a nervous system so that he could help paraplegics and quadriplegics. High moral idea, but he was experimenting on humans. The hero stood against him, and the villain tried to persuade the hero to join him, this doctor, join him. Did anyone know the show, please? Extreme Measures, thank you. The villain, who's a good villain because he's trying to help humanity, tries to persuade the hero, who's a bit dim, that he should help him in doing these operations. And the hero has to argue. He says, yes, I can see you're doing good things. Yes, it would be valuable to help people doing this, but you are forcing them. And now where do we go in the logic? How can I argue that this should not be done? And you are not God, said the hero. Because there is no other place you can argue from at that point, is there? Why not experiment on humans for the better good? Why not cure millions from people who are going to die of drug overdoses on the streets anyway? Why not do that? Because you are not God, is the answer. There is the point in chapter 5. When you make a vow to God, don't delay in fulfilling it. You see, you're not God. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It's better not to vow than to make a vow and not fulfill it. Don't let your mouth lead you into sin. Do not... So the whole point comes at 5:7. Therefore stand in awe of God. For the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. When we stand in the fear of God, then we will understand about our possessions properly. That they are given to us by God for our enjoyment. Under God, we will not stand in rebellion against God. See, in the New Testament, we're told the love of money is the root of all evil. But in that same passage, we're taught that the rich in this world are not to be arrogant or put their hope in wealth, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides everything for our enjoyment. There's nothing wrong in material possessions. What's wrong is in our attitude towards them. How do we get a right attitude towards them? By recognising that there's something bigger in this universe than our material possessions, something bigger in this universe than us. It is the God who has given us those material possessions for our enjoyment. When we have the fear of God, then, and only then, we will have the wisdom to know what to do with our possessions. Not to move into the countercultural dropout, nor into the materialistic pursuit, but in the acceptance and enjoyment of them. Ecclesiastes 4-6 speaks fairly directly to life under the Australian sun, because we live in a materialistic society, passionately concerned about being wealthy enough to be apathetic about everything. We live in that meaningless Prozac kind of existence where we try to soak up enough sun, but not too much, lest we get skin cancer. And around us are people living in oppression and difficulty in Indonesia, in Sudan, in Bangkok, around the world people are living good. We don't know, want to know about it, because for us in Australia, let's eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But friends, there's more to this life than that. And it's not true that tomorrow we die, because the day after is the resurrection, when we will stand before God and give account for what we have done with the wonderful life that he's given us. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank you for the great things you've given to us, for life and for pleasure, for wealth and for work, and we pray that you would help us to so stand in awe of you that we might truly understand this life and its meaning, that we might stand on that last day in the resurrection and be able to give account to what we have done with the great wealth that you have given to us. So help us to enjoy it in the light of our knowledge of you. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.